In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Hey everybody, Jim Hoffman here for EMS Office Hours.
And Josh Knapp.
Josh, here we are, the last show of the year.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I'm so excited.
Hold on, I'm getting...
You're getting a phone call.
A phone call?
I don't know, what the hell noise? That's
no,
is that your ringtone?
No, there's an ad. Crap. And, of course, this happens on our last show.
Josh, this is the last show. The last show, and you're over there acting like it's your first time getting on the show.
Office Hours just ran away.
I understand.
It ran away. There was some pop-up that locked into my browser, and I had to just get out and get back in. So,
oh, my God.
There it is. I'm in. We have no music in the background. We're there. We have Joe and John in the... in the chat room. We're good to go, man. It's the last of the year.
You are correct.
And well, unlike our topic, I ain't hanging up this show.
I know. Well, let me tell you something. You know, I want to mention, next year we're going to actually be having some sponsors for the show.
Next year? Really?
Yeah, starting January, which is pretty cool.
Like that free beer?
No, you're not getting a free beer.
Oh, come on, man. What's the point? Well, here, we have sponsors. Why don't we get free beer?
It's not Budweiser or anything like that, or it's not a Super Bowl sponsor. So.
What the hell are you doing, man?
I know.
You're getting sponsors.
Well, it's sort of a group sponsorship between EMS Office Hours, a couple other blogs, the ProBen Network. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be good for it. I'm actually, I'll talk to you about it later, Josh, but I want to give you some opportunity to kind of peruse the sponsor so you can get a handle on the product or the service and be able to talk about it with me when we bring it up on the show. But with that said, also going to try to...
You're asking a lot, man. I'm just letting you know.
But, with that said as well, also going to be working the show a little bit differently, I think, in 2013, Josh, bringing to light, I think, and to the forefront some of the more popular things going on out there in the EMS interwebs and blogs and things like that, and trying to give... you know, a bigger voice to some of those topics, which is why I chose put some of the things I chose today. I thought it was interesting. You had actually brought to my attention that whole thing about EMTs. You know, it used to be, what was it, the top 10 worst jobs
in
2012. And now, apparently, according to CareerCast.com, they're not in the worst top 10 any longer.
No, it's something like out of 200, we're now 120. So we've moved up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, a whole 60 points.
It's a Christmas miracle.
But did you read the social medic? He did a sort of a thing on that. And he sort of highlighted a couple of points that I thought was kind of interesting. It's like, the job really hasn't changed that much, but they sort of fudge the numbers to make it look like it's changed.
I'm not. What is the purpose of that? I read Dave Koenig is the author of the Social Medic. He's also involved with social media training, and he also is the sort of the wizard behind the scenes here at the EMS Blogs Network as well, but. I'm reading the article, and it's funny. Like you said, he did mention something like $12 or something like that.
Paid less.
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 than we made, you know.
Well, it's not always money, and you always, whenever you go onto the blogs, as you well know, whenever you say, "Oh, we don't get paid enough" or anything else, you always get stomped by somebody who says, "Oh, I've been volunteering at this for, you know, 35 years, and I don't need to get paid anything. I don't need anybody to tell me I'm great.
I need
and
it's to get
like,
paid."
Here's a pat on the back. Yeah, exactly. You
I
know,
need to get paid.
For some of us who want to concentrate in the field and get, and if you want to get good on it, you can't do something else, you know, without, you can't do something else full time. You know, maybe you can, but if you don't do this full time, you're just not going to be as good as the players who are doing it full time. I'm just sorry, it's not going to happen. You're going to see more jobs, you're going to do more jobs, you're going to get more training. Than if you do it part time.
Sure, well,
shoot me if you would only.
Ends up being a numbers game, I guess.
Well, you know, it is. I mean, look, there's a lot of you and we had a discussion the other day, and I was talking about the name of the book now escapes me, but there's an aspect of that, you know. Of succeeding in the job place is not only being in the right place at the right time, but the number of hours that you spend perfecting the craft, so to speak. So no matter what you want to do, if you spend more hours doing it, you generally will be better than the people who spend less hours doing it. You know, and that's sort of a numbers thing, and I know there's always going to be exceptions to the rule, but generally speaking, you know, you have a stone craftsman out there who spent 10,000 hours carving stone. He's going to be better than the guy who spent 5,000 hours carving stone.
Well, I'm looking at Dave's article, and, you know, he talked a little bit about the physical demand somehow. That's decreased. I'm not sure where.
Yeah,
I don't even know if we should be even paying attention to this type of thing. But, like, you see a website
well, you have to
that
pay, hold on. Wait a second. You have to pay attention to this. I'm going to tell you, you have to pay attention to this because this is these are sort of the numbers. And you're always going to have people out there who say the numbers don't lie. And regardless to how you may feel on the job, if you you go up against somebody and say, well, it's a feeling, and somebody goes, well, this number, and they have a specific methodology that they figured out, you know, the difficulty of this, it's going to be a hard fight to win. And keep in mind that last year, you know, along with the 10 worst jobs, along as being in the 10 worst jobs, were things like roughneck, you know, on an oil rig.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how we suddenly moved 80 positions or 60 positions further down the line or 70 positions, whatever turns out to actually be the number. But you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, how are you going to prove that? How are you not going to pay attention to an article that comes out about jobs by a job, you know, website?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that Dave mentioned too, she shows their ranking methodology.
You got it.
Man, I am getting smart on this show.
Yeah.
I can say big words.
You're picking up my bad habits.
So, you know, he puts a link for that there so that you can kind of see how they do their rankings, you know, understand how this website comes up with these numbers. But again, I think Dave, like myself, and I think other people out there as well are in EMS, are kind of just thinking maybe you'd like to, you know, have someplace else, sort of giving a much more accurate view on EMS and things like the physical demand. I mean, I don't see how the physical demands are going to decrease at all ever. In this job, if anything, it's getting worse because of increase in call volume in a lot of places, increase in obese patients, you know, I think if anything, the physical demands would be increasing. To me, that would be a more realistic,
I
portrayal
absolutely agree.
on
I
that.
don't know how they do that. Even if you put into the equation things like power stretchers and stair chairs you don't have to lift, you still have to get the patient in. You still have to hustle the equipment. It seems as a medic, every time you turn around, you're getting something else to carry,
I was
you
going to
know.
say, right. I mean, even if you've got some things that are kind of helping you, stair chairs with the tracks and automatic stretchers, there's still seems to be more equipment that as especially on the ALS end of it, where you're bringing in more equipment into the house.
Look.
It might just be a cable. You know what I mean? But like now, for me, for instance, we've got modems that we have to carry that aren't all that light into houses to transmit 12 leads or abnormal EKGs and whatnot to the emergency department. So those modems, they're not heavy, but when you add it to the rest of the life pack, and everything else you're dragging in, that stuff adds up. I'm
No.
sorry. I mean, that whatever, half a pound or a pound or whatever it could be, it's a pound I didn't have to carry last year.
Listen, I've done long distance camping and, gone out for 30 days at a time, and the leaders on those type of tours usually go, when you're packing up your pack, they look at you and they say, "Do you really need that? Think about it carefully, because you're whatever you take in with new camping, whatever you take in, you take out. It's clean camping." But what we say are ounces or pounds. And anytime you carry something repeatedly, every time you pick it up, that ounce multiplies. So
Yeah.
that,
Well,
4 more pounds that you have to lift.
hey, listen, when I was in the Army, and I'm sure John in the chat can vouch for this, when you're in basic training and you're carrying that rucksack on your back, you're almost carrying everything you think you can think of because you're terrified, you're going to get in trouble from the drill sergeants and stuff. But after a while, once you sort of been doing it for a little bit, you figure out what you don't have to bring, to make it as light as possible.
100%,
You know,
100%.
I remember carrying a certain amount with me all the time, and all of a sudden one day, first sergeant decided that this was the hike that I was going to get to carry the radio.
Oh, lucky you.
So the radio that got this big radio now getting stuffed into the ruck, along with everything else, and I'm ended up with whatever amount of pounds that the radio ended up being, and having to keep up, with the first sergeant running around all over the place, like a maniac throughout the entire,
Right.
march. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, it's just the type of thing where you gotta, I think that's what I had, John, with the 77 there. But but it's the type of thing, like you said,
Remember, John, he was in a while
That
ago,
was,
a
yeah.
long time
They
ago.
had horses back then, so.
But and we've addressed that point as well, on being a sloppy provider. Not some people, after a while, they sort of been there, done it all, seen it all, and they don't need to take in that piece of equipment anymore because they know this job from the radio call, or they know this job from the dispatch, and we've addressed that, that you sort of have to, you're supposed to be taking that equipment in, and if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're carrying that. It doesn't make the system that makes us carry that or designs this equipment as it's the only thing that we're going to be carrying. I mean, what would be really great is if they started to look at what we do on the job in its entirety and design the systems that we need to go and treat patients with instead of just, this single thing. Like, you know what? I love the functionality of the life pack. I really, truly do. And we're getting 15s this year. And I'm excited about that. And the new NiCad batteries should be a little lighter and all of that other stuff. But the truth of the matter is, it's still a big box. And you hip it, you swing it on and it's banging against your hip. It doesn't fit right with a backpack.
You gotta scratch your head with that stuff, Josh. Because it's like
No, I don't.
you've got these iPads and iPhones, and why can't we have lightweight devices to do 12 leads? you know?
There are lightweight devices to do 12 leads. We can't do it because, you know, it's a whole supply chain situation that we've got where they're only going to pick from certain vendors that are supplying certain things. And they're already.
We've talked about priorly.
Sure.
Well,
you know, we cover a lot of shit on this show.
I know we do.
We do.
We're always,
because we are enlightened medics.
I'm something. Well, it's funny, you know, talking about, you know, deciding what to use and who makes these decisions. I actually put a post on my Facebook page. You ever see the, have you seen that new show Amish Mafia? Have you seen that?
You know what? I've seen the ads for it, but
that show.
I can't bring myself to watch it. I'm sorry.
God.
Sorry, the commercials are enough.
I'm loving it. But listen, I put a thing on my Facebook page saying, "What if there was an EMS mafia?" You know, and you think about
the trouble is if we send somebody out to break somebody's kneecaps.
It doesn't have to be violent.
Okay.
Why can't it just be the influence that it can carry? To make it so that we can carry these lighter devices, we can get these as being the more mainstream devices and equipment that we can use in this system that does make it easier for the provider, less, and does decrease the physical demands saying we have, and also can provide the same, if not better, patient care.
All right. You want to know the truth? Can you handle the truth? You're not going to like it. You're not going to like it. And you know the answer already because we're replaceable. So it's more important that they provide a package, an affordable package on which you can place an EMT or medic than it is that we preserve the EMT or medic.
Yeah.
And I'm really, you know, I mean, I'm really coming to grips with that. I wanted to say it's not true. I wanted to say, you know, like any good work environment, they want to culture their resources and develop their resources and keep their resources. But I don't see that. I don't see proof of that anywhere. Mm-hmm. I see it as an ass in the seat and we are expendable. And it's really a sad statement. And that's, you know, it's sort of leads into your other topic whenever you want to get there. But, you know, I'm looking at what Joe is saying here. He said, one company I worked for attached the monitor to a table that attached it to a C-clamp that went on the foot of the gurney. Yeah, that's all good, Joe. But, you know, I don't know, you know, maybe you did work in an urban environment. But like you were saying before, why can't the transition happen at the ambulance? Because you've got to put somebody in that stair chair, move them out to the stretcher, get them into the stretcher as soon as you can, and then get the stretcher into the back of the bus because sometimes there's not enough room to maneuver at the back of the bus.
Yeah, I mean, think about that, Josh.
A lot of crap associated with that, you know, patient movement.
Yeah, think about moving a patient like that, cardiac arrest patients, critical patients, where you end up.
How many have you put on a longboard? You know, you brought the stair chair up. They go into a rest. You know, they're sick. They go into a rest. Now you're doing CPR. Now you got to move them on a longboard. The elevator doesn't work, or the elevator's not big enough, and now you got to carry them down those narrow stairs.
But the thing is, too, like you take something like the monitor, like trying to keep that attached to a patient as you're moving them like
that. Yeah, that happens.
It's almost impossible.
Yeah, that happens, right?
You know, so. I mean, just thinking about, you know, the better patient care and having something lighter to
the standard of patient care?
You know, and then the standard of keeping them attached to these things. So we all make these excuses of, well, we'll just get them as fast as we can and we'll hook them up again, you know, periodically. And, yeah, we try to minimize that. But the reality is, unfortunately, is that, you know, there are times when a lead will come off, or you have to disconnect it to get through a doorway or to get into that elevator, you know?
Right, right. And you don't, you know, what it is you have to sacrifice the better good for, and I don't want to say the greater good because it's usually associated with groups of people, but you have to sacrifice one thing for the other. And sometimes, you know, it's leads disconnected because that happens when you're moving a patient. I mean, you can't, that's not something that can be avoided even under the best of conditions. And, you know, okay, well, we're going to make this turn down this stairway first before we reach to put the leads back on, because lo and behold, if we tried to do that, it would be dangerous for everybody involved. And, yes. You know, so you have to default to certain of the best of the worst choices.
Yeah.
And that's sort of.
And this is, I mean, this is why.
All the fucking time.
And I think this is why, too, a lot of places, a lot of the thought process of not transporting, you know, cardiac arrest patients is becoming more and more the goal, you know, because you're not. You're interrupting CPR for too long. You're not able to monitor them when you move them. And, you know, it's not doing the patient any good. You're better off just staying on scene and doing what you can do, doing everything you can do for the patient there rather than transporting them when they're going to get the same epi, the same defibrillation, you know, at the hospital.
Right.
You know.
You know, you definitely try to get ROSC before you.
When you want to think about transporting. But otherwise, exactly. This thought process of,
but
well, the family.
You do it.
You know, the thing is, that I actually had a discussion with somebody recently because the protocols are going to be changing soon, where, by me anyway, where they're going to be focused more on that. They're going to be focused more on the stay in place and do CPR, work the patient up, and if you're not getting any sort of response, to call a doctor and get a pronouncement time. You know, now when I worked in the city, that was a common occurrence. You know, you would work a patient up and then you would, you know, pronounce them if there was no response
right.
from what you're doing.
Right.
But some people have this mindset that, you know, well, the family's not ready for that. They don't want you to do that. You know. They're expecting you to transport. You can't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but that's
the family wants you to transport.
That's still part of the overall, if you want to say it, unwritten protocol. You know, it's the same thing that if you have, you know, what's the thing that they tell you when you find a kid in arrest? You
yeah.
know, you transport regardless of what the downtime
but
is.
Shouldn't we as professionals and as healthcare providers be able to tell a family member and make them understand the fact that transporting their what is dead relative to the hospital is not going to benefit anybody? If anything, you know, they should understand that it could have a worse outcome by transporting. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. I don't think that you're going to get anywhere with that statement. I think that there's an aspect that we need. First of all, we need to be considered medical professionals within the structure of mm-hmm. medicine. And, you know, in that very definition, you're allowed to say, no, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. And I think that even if you were a doctor under those conditions of being at in this day and age, when even a doctor's word is something that can be questioned, and is,
hey, that's
you know,
Joe.
There's an, yeah, Joe, well, Joe knows that. it used to be, oh, mighty doctors. Well, what happened when you were an EMT? You were told, said, oh, mighty paramedic, paragods, right?
Well,
but the situation
as
is,
it should be.
I'm sorry to even bridge that gap, to bridge that subject with you, Jim. But let me finish my sentence. It should be that you should be able to say that, but reality sets in. And if a family is truly distraught and it's the lesser of two evils, then you transport that person to quote-unquote definitive care where somebody else or a group of their support system. And even in, you know, even in medic class, you are sort of said that if somebody is – you know, if you pronounce on scene or before you pronounce on scene, consider the support mechanism that the family has. You know, you may not want to leave a distraught single, you know, entity at home alone to deal with this death. You may want to bring them into the hospital where they have that support structure. They can get somebody to talk to, you know, they can get that I keep on saying support structure. I'm not thinking of another word for it, but they can get that when they need it.
Yeah.
At home, being distraught, being alone.
Yeah, but, no, I see what you're saying. I see what you mean, but I think that it's still we have to take, you know, take it as it's going to be part of the job. It's going to be part of that end of what we are going to have to do, because I just don't think it's going to be, it's just not going to help the patient, you know, and I think we're giving false hope to family when we do that, you know.
I agree, but we're getting off onto
Yeah, I don't want to go too much into that whole cardiac arrest pit crew approach type thing that's going on, but I think it's a good sort of
along with that thought of the, you know, we should have more autonomy in the field, which is, I think, is the end argument of your statement, is the ability to say, I don't think you need an ambulance, ma'am.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. Right, that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, right. But it goes hand in hand with that being, you know, having that autonomy. And yeah. It looks like the way things are going today, practitioners in EMS are never going to get that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of, yeah, you know, something, Josh, that's part of the other article I want to mention today, you know.
So how do you get that, right?
Well, yeah. Bob Sullivan, he's a frequent caller on the show and joins us often on the show as well. He did an article about EMS people and physician assistant, becoming a physician assistant. I don't know if you read the article or not.
I did.
One thing that sort of, you know, he had a lot of notes in there. We'll hit some of the highlights of the topic. Also some of the people that commented on his post as well. But I think what he wants, something he kind of brings it home at the end of his article, and he says what he wants, he wants what PAs in the United States have and what paramedics in some other countries have. This is something you mentioned a couple minutes ago too, is that he wants EMS in the United States to value the longevity of the profession, embrace that formal education, and develop areas for us to specialize in. And this is something that we've talked about as well, as far as having a specialized sort of not branch, but people who sort of specialize in things like pediatrics and bariatrics and geriatrics and things like that, that can be called upon when there are issues that arise within an agency, you know. And one thing he sort of ends his article with here is he talks about how he wants, you know, paramedics and EMS, he wants them to be organized and be united under one mission. And for
right.
the communities that we're involved in, the communities that we're serving, know what the hell it is that we do.
Well, Jim, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum, and I'm always willing to talk about that subject again and again because I think it's an important one.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is, when you're on the ER deck or you're at the station house and you talk to other EMS, is anybody different? Does anybody think, no, we're fine the way we are? I mean, in reality, there's always going to be some people who are going to argue that point. But for the group, the professionals, the people who, you know, take the job, you know, to heart and do it all the time, do you ever find that they're saying, no, we're organized enough, things are great as they are?
No, of course not.
Okay.
You know, but the thing that I guess I have the issue with is that I don't know necessarily what the answer is. And, you know, looking at, I don't know if it is it just education. I mean, part of it is he mentioned about PAs, you know, starting around the same time as paramedics came into play, you know.
Yeah, but not anywhere near the breadth and depth that paramedics operate in. I mean, if you look at where PAs are, they're definitely in, they've definitely sort of grown out of the need to spread as a different way to spread definitive care and sort of medical supervision over the idea of the shortage of doctors. But at the same time, whenever you speak, PA, it's really, you don't do it a service if you don't mention nursing, because nursing is there. They're trying for equality. They're really, I mean, you got to be impressed that PAs exist at all with the strength of the nursing unions and the nursing sort of body, because they're out there, and some, there are nurses that seem to be equally responsible in terms of the patient care chain of command as PAs. You know, there are nurses out there, nurse practitioners can write scripts, they can diagnose problems, there are surgical tech nurses, there's sort of an equal plane. It seems almost like a redundancy. I'm looking at trying to see.
Well, Joe mentioned yeah, something as far as change in EMS, and I think he makes a good point when you talk about how we talk amongst ourselves about how we would like EMS to take different paths and things like that. But you mentioned something which I think is true, where a large portion, does want someone else to fix the problems for them.
Oh, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think that.
Yeah, but see, I think I do, Josh. I'm going to just give you just a small example of that, right? You've got people who bitch and moan about EMS and whether it's pay or education or the calls we do and whatever, right? But then you've got avenues that something like even this show, for instance, right, where we'll get, 2,000, 3,000 listeners per episode of the show, right? Mm-hmm. Why aren't we getting tens of thousands that would be more interested? To me, it's the 2,000 people listening to the show that are ones that are really interested in making the change and who are probably out there voicing their concerns more. But it's the tens of thousands of people that should be listening to shows like this and others
and
that are
engaged
out there. And being engaged, yeah,
in the conversation,
right,
and being proactive in their own areas.
Right.
And the answer is, well, the answer that we've come up with, that we've discussed, is generally that these people, because of the structure of EMS and the people that have the most to gain by some organization, some raising the bar, so to speak, are the people who are working the hardest. They're working two or three jobs, and they honestly don't have time. They don't have the time or the energy. And you and I were talking about this offline the other day. You were saying, listen, I work 2-3 days a week. I'm on 24-hour shifts, or 2 days a week you're on 24-hour shifts, and you still come back, and that burns up your time because you need a full day to recover from a 24.
Yeah.
And so, it's still like you're working 4 or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And that's about the amount of time that you have to do anything else productive. And at the same time, with that said, you still manage to, work on your website, work on the testing software, do the blog, do this audio show. I mean, come on. I work full time and I run a manufacturing business. So, where do we have time to really engage in that other than our passion and our belief in EMS?
My thing is that, I'm not saying everybody has to listen to EMS office hours. I'm just saying just in general, even if it's just a fact of working inside their own organization to make a significant change in a local protocol that's just way outdated, or getting equipment updated, or getting something like better benefits or better training even on things. You know what I mean? It seems like, and I've seen this just in the places that I've worked, where you've got people who just come in, they punch the card, and they want to go home. But then,
well, there are always going to be those people. there are always going to be those people. I mean,
they're the same people that are unhappy with the way things are, but not willing to make any sort of effort.
You know, you got to chalk those ones up to the same people that sit there and bitch about the government and don't vote. You know what? You know, if you're not going to participate, then really shut up. Honestly, I don't want to hear your political views if you're not going to vote. At the same time, if you're not going to get and be motivated to do something to raise the bar on the profession that we're in, don't bitch about where you're at.
Yeah.
You know, you earn the right to bitch when you do something to change the environment. Yeah. You know, otherwise you got to be happy with it. I personally think, you know, that could be a little bit of a harsh statement, but, you know, you got to pay to play.
Looking at Bob's article too, I mean, there's a lot of things he talks about with PAs, you know, as far as increase in salary that they make and, you know, where you've got PAs who can work someplace for a long period of time and it's not really looked at as being sort of a dead end type thing.
But that is also, wait a second, that's also the sort of the scenario that you get within the hospital borders. Within a good hospital structure, that's where you start to get development of resources and the idea that they want to keep the identity of the person doing the patient treatment the same. That's where it sort of fractures when you get out there in the field and you're in EMS, and as everybody has said over time and again, it's a warm ass in the seat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something that Bob mentioned. I don't know if you read the article or not, but he says that in the article too, where he's actually had management say to him that, you know, everybody is replaceable.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah. That's a big problem. I mean, when you look at it, you have to look at it as two different things. And that's sometimes, and Bob also mentions that, that's why you get that sort of, there is not a transition really from EMS to something else. You leave EMS.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, some people hang on for a little while and do their other thing while they're, you know, then they go to part-time or mm-hmm. something like that. But that's, especially when you're going in another medical profession, that's more rare than it is. Than it is common.
Well, I had a partner.
I freaking shame.
I had a recent partner. He went to medical school. You know, and left EMS altogether to go to medical school.
Yeah. Well, there's a total conflict of interest there.
You know. I mean, I actually knew a guy who became a PA and he hated it. You know, and I think, and part of it is because of what Bob had mentioned in his post about a lot of times the PA ends up in the fast track area doing a lot of those, you know, sick calls and you know, low, you know, priority type patients. And they're the same patients that, you know, as a paramedic, you know, you hate getting those calls of, you know, for the flu or the fever or the joint pain and things like that. You know, and he was overwhelmed. It was like there was no – he worked in the emergency room as a PA. And it was,
right.
It was,
there's no break.
There was no break. And it was like they would give him a break, but it was like if I took my break, I could never catch up on my charting. I can never catch up on patients that are looking to be treated and get out of there and the ER is backing up. And he would say he would work, you know, 8 to 12 hours and never really have a significant break. And he ended up going back on the ambulance. He ended up
and the bad news,
being paramedic.
The bad news is it's just going to get worse. It's not going to get better because the whole aspect of emergency care is now going from, you know, well, we've made some mistakes when we discharge people too soon from the emergency room, so we're going to move them to observation units. So it's going to extend that sort of purgatory that a patient arrives and doesn't quite get into a hospital but doesn't quite get out of the hospital, you know, until they really know what's going on. And what's that another excuse for? It's another excuse to do more tests and more probes. You know, it's absolute joy as as a patient. And I think that there's got to be some, you know, obviously we've taught, you know, in the general conversation, there is, you know, the statement that our medical system has to change. But in the immediate conversation, the EMS system has to change as well. And I don't think that it's naturally, I think that it's not that there's a stepping stone to nursing or PA. I think that it's a survival mode of, yeah, I can't do the same type of work anymore.
Yeah, I think you made a good point before when you talked about how it's not a stepping stone. It's not a natural real progression that you're going to be, okay, I'm going to be EMT, then I'm going to be a medic, then I'm going to be a PA, or then I'm going to be a nurse. It's like you're going to go be a PA, you're going to be a nurse. Most of the time, you're going to leave EMS. I mean, I do know nurses who stayed as, you know, medics or as EMTs. I know one person who's a nurse. He's a flight medic and everything,
yeah,
else. He's a state trooper. He's got the whole bag of hats. He can throw any hat on he wants at any given time.
There are absolutely exceptions to the rule.
Yeah.
Absolutely exceptions to
but
the
I
rule.
Think the most part, like you
but
said.
Even but those exceptions, even on themselves, are exceptions to the rule, because you get these people who are flight medics. You get these people who work in a system where you need to be sort of a transport nurse. So they have this, like, nurse paramedic thing going on.
Yeah.
But how many people out of the – if you looked and counted all the people who are, quote-unquote, EMS, how many – what would the percentage be of those individuals who also have that combined nursing degree and work in both worlds?
Yeah.
You know?
You know, like in Jersey, the, you know, nurses are highly sought after. If you're a nurse and a medic – you know, they'd love to get you to put you on the ambulance because then they can run. They have a critical care sort of.
Because why? Because who makes the ultimate decision in the New Jersey State of Health?
Yeah.
About transport. Transport skills and accreditation. A nurse.
Yes, the nurse. You know, for a lot of cities in Jersey, they want to have that because then that's the type of unit they can staff. And they can send that unit on a transport, on a 911 call, on an A-list call, B-list call. Doesn't matter, because once the person is a nurse and the medic, they can go ahead and you know, do it all, you know. But they're paying, though. They're paying that person, the nurse's salary, to be on the ambulance.
I have to apologize, by the way, as a side, that I can't be that super active on the chat room today. I'm in a wrist cast because I tore a couple of ligaments in my elbow, so I'm not supposed to be flexing my wrist too much, and it's making all things like typing a real pain in the ass.
Typing and other things.
Anything else? Anything
other things else. With your
all,
wrist.
All things with my wrist, right? Like saying hello.
It's funny.
Stop.
One thing that John mentioned, too, is why don't paramedics demand that only paramedics oversee EMS? And I think there's what the hell was it, man? I can't remember now. I just read something on that where there's one state or one region where the medics are in charge of protocols and all that stuff.
I would believe it.
Where the hell
was
that? I just freaking read it. Like
it can happen.
Or where they get doc's approval, but the medics are the ones that
right
to
look
spearhead
at it
everything.
And say, this
they
is what we can
right.
do. Right.
They spearhead it all, you know, and they do all that type of stuff. So, you know, just it's weird. Joe's trying to scare me now. You know, you talked about California. The nurses give med control orders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
I'm not either.
It's a political thing. It's not. When are we going to stop this bullshit that we think that this is all about patient care? This is rarely about patient care.
Well, it is. I mean, think about some of the stuff that we do, and
it's
I know
political.
Right. Well, it's political, and it's also because we're doing it because we've been doing it for so long that there's not, you know, there's no, it's working. You know, so let's say like in California, the nurses are doing that. You know, giving med control and whatnot, you know, it works for them. So they're not going to change it. They'll change it when there's a big enough lawsuit that, that changes it, or there's enough public opinion to try to change it, you know. Otherwise, they're not in a big hurry. This is something, I know Tim, the Rogue Medic, he's been on this show a bunch of times, and he talks about that, about how we're doing things over and over again that, you know, there's no research that says it does, that it provides any benefit, and some of it even shows that it hurts people, but yet we keep doing it because we've been doing it for so long and nobody wants to change it. And then this is everything from American Heart Association, you know, across the board to even to local, you know, docs and stuff that don't want to change things because they're just too afraid, or they just want to be able to say you're doing something.
Or it's not convenient, or it's not a priority because many other things.
Exactly.
You know, we had a visit yesterday from a friend of ours who's a doc, and she actually met a young man who happens to be in the drug industry. And he, and not like on the street corner, like in the pharmaceutical industry.
Uh-huh.
Like there's a big difference. And he was lamenting about how, you know, they want to do these educational programs in the hospitals, but the hospitals don't want their name attached. And the drug industries won't do it unless they can attach their name, because they want to do anything they do has to have some PR value. And I'm like, you know what? You're so part of the dark side.
Right.
That, you know, you've tainted your history so much that you have to do some altruistic acts in order to get the respect you need in order to be able to initiate this quote-unquote training. And nobody's going to believe that you're going to train, that you're going to give information that's not going to be slanted in some way towards your product line. So you could talk about a disease and a disease process with the overall idea of integrating your product into the care process, but you're still going to break down because people are already going to think, you know, well, of course you're going to make it so yours drug is the best way to treat this disease, and your brand is the best drug to use to treat the disease.
I was funny. I was just I was working with a company a few months ago. I was
free tents and free meals. Yeah,
I was trying to work with them to get a educational programs up online on talking about
the SLEP show,
talking about giving medications to people based on their genetics and not based on, you know, like Joe's saying, how many free pens and you know, keychains, calendars, and meals.
No, it's, you're not allowed to get pens anymore.
Yeah.
You're supposed to, you can only be treated to meals for the entire office. They can't show favoritism. There's a whole bunch of things that came out with this.
Well, I thought it was interesting, though, that the
me too.
Talking about the genetic end of it.
Who do you think I stole my pens from?
Oh.
No, go ahead. Talk about the genetics.
You're sitting there, you have a little stencil, and you go buy them by the box at Staples and spray paint.
Excuse me?
paint your logo on every pen. You know, you don't want to spend the money to have it done by whatever marketing firm will do it.
Some of those pens were pretty nice.
Mm.
Just saying.
No, but I think it's just – but again, this is something where you get resistance. You talk about – just to mention this genetic thing for a second, just because it's just something that's like outside the box, right? It's outside the norm. They're trying to figure out ways to give people medications based on their genetics and not necessarily just on a diagnosis or just on, you know, oh, you have hypertension, you're getting this drug because I've been giving this drug to every hypertensive patient that comes through the door, or this antibiotic because, you know, everything's, you know, this is the one that we've been using, it's the most popular one right now, this is the one we're giving out. You know, I've got the free samples, you know, and this mm-hmm. is what we're gonna try type thing. But again, I think there's elements of that as far as when we're talking about change, you know, there's some element of it being because it's the way it's always been done, because and I think the biggest thing, I think, like you said, Josh, is the fact that there's no need to, there's no hurry to do it.
Well,
There's no time.
That's the point, Jim. I mean, how else do we get suicide as a side effect of antidepressants and think it's acceptable? Yeah. I mean, at what point
the
sanity rule? Where does that take over? Where is that part of the transition, you know, that there's going to be a sane, logical conversation that somebody suffering from depression might be at risk of suicide to start with?
Those are my favorite warnings, you know.
I mean, you know, it's when the treatment's worse than the disease, you got to reexamine the treatment.
Yeah. Hi, who's on the air with us?
This is Bob.
Hey, Bob. Broke away for a minute.
What's that?
You're able to break away for a few minutes?
Yes.
Were your ears burning, Bob? We were talking about you.
I actually haven't. This is the first I've been able to get on. I'm at work, and the EMS gods frowned on me
not
for the past
popular.
Hour.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, let's see. Well, I mean, like, I have had this sore throat for, like, 4 weeks now, so I got to call an ambulance tonight.
Well, because it's going to be New Year's soon. You got to get to the hospital.
The BLS is going to upgrade that into a diff breather because their throat is swollen.
So, Bob, we were just talking about your post on your blog about that PA thing. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about, you know, how it's not necessarily a natural progression, becoming a PA or becoming a nurse, that it's not sort of like that part of the ladder, you know?
No, and some people would like it to be.
Yeah.
I think with the PA, just because I know that more paramedics that I've worked with, different services, you know, when they get sick of being a paramedic and they realize the career opportunities for advancement are what they are.
Maybe they have
the few that we do have seem to take you away from clinical practice and more like in the office, away from patient care.
Supervisor stuff for QA and all that type of stuff.
Yes. So, and there's also a lot of respect with it. I mean, when you become a PA, you've made it. And that's for people that are enlightened in the medical community, they know that that's the high-paying job. It's a master's, you're a master's level clinician. Depending on where you are, you get a lot of clinical privileges in the hospital. And there seems to be a lot more to be a PA, even if you do the same work at the same place for the same amount of time and do the same, you know, type of work, that seems to be more accepted than being a paramedic. Everybody kind of expects you to grow out of it. You know, I just had a conversation today with someone, like, oh, so this is it, huh? You're just going to keep doing this? And we don't say that about PAs and a lot of other, or law enforcement or other professions.
Yeah. I read some of your posts, some of the responses to the posts, and I see Brandon from EMS Basics had made a comment talking about how he's actually going to PA school himself in the coming year.
We're losing good people. I mean, if anybody's going to make EMS better, the people that can do it are the ones that are, you know, leaving for other things.
Listen, one of the best ALS partners I've had, Bob, and he is an ALS and PEDS instructor, is in school right now and trying to get into PA school. And so there is the brain drain that happens to this profession. So we're not able to keep the really skilled professionals in the job, in the seat, to maybe transfer some of those skills, some of that knowledge to the next group of people coming in because they're leaving. And there's no desire, I think, I don't think there's any desire by management to retain those professionals as well. At least they're not given the tools to, even if they're enlightened enough to do that. I heard that sigh.
I really think that if I could wave a magic wand and get us to value longevity, it would be to raise our education standards and lower the supply of people, because there is this endless supply of people coming out of, you know, paramedic and EMT diploma factories that allow that to continue. And if that were to dry up, I mean, in Canada, it takes to do BLS, it takes 2 years of a full-time in college. And they have people that work a long time. I mean, I know Rob Terrio and the Educants mentioned once that they can't get rid of people. They hang around so long. So I think I'd rather have that problem than the high turnover we have here.
Yeah, I mean, really do you see, if you know, I mean, listen, the places that I've resigned from, I was never, encouraged to stay. Like, they needed me there so badly, you know.
No, and they don't, but, and I talk about McAmbulance. That was my first job. My one partner was very good, taught me, you know, almost everything I know to this day. You know, he was told that it doesn't matter. You can be the best paramedic or the worst paramedic, but you're a spot on a schedule to a lot of workplaces. You can be replaced as long as we don't value the quality of care that gets delivered is much less important than how long it takes us to get there and,
yeah,
you know, how long we can get ready for the next call.
Yeah.
So.
No,
I'm
you're right. I mean, I think the article was really good, Bob, and I think the comments you got from some of the other bloggers out there were, you know, it's just amazing to me how and again, me and Josh talked about this earlier on today too, Bob, about how the mentality seems to be the same in EMS, but it's like there's not enough people that are willing to stick around to try to make, you know, the changes, you know, to try to push it in a direction so that we can have things that you mentioned and we've talked about in the show too, about having sort of those specialty areas, you know, for paramedics and increasing the education and figuring out ways to make it a career that when you're in it for 20 years, somebody doesn't say, oh my God, you know, that's what, you know, you've been a medic for 20 years, you know, that's all you've done or whatever, you know.
Listen. Bob has hit it on the head that until we have that educational step, until we have that it is a transition, not a disassociation, we won't get there. I mean, if you look at even the trades where they have guys who are steam fitters or guys who are electricians, you go up the trades from – you know, from like, I don't remember what the very first start is, but I remember after your first year, you get to graduate to like a journeyman. And then after, you know, 5 years as a journeyman, then you get to finally sort of graduate to being that profession. And then there's still a level where you're a master at that profession. And so, you know, you can spend 30, 40 years in that profession and, you know, continually move up the ladder where your skills are necessary and needed. We don't have that. And I think that's the main gap.
Too old to work, too young to retire is written about that. If I can find the post, maybe you could add it to the show notes. But he goes through a whole thing about how to make EMS a trade. And while you throw words like trade and profession and, you know,
I don't think it's fitting for something that really requires – that has to belong in the sort of the academic curriculum. And I think that's where, you know, when you're dealing with medicine, I think that it's very important to sort of keep the idea of education mainstream with the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say I am more optimistic than I have ever been before because I think there's enough bloggers and smart people that are starting to be in charge and supervisors that want to do the things that we talk about. And certainly you guys are pioneers in podcasting. I think I think we're headed in the right direction. I just hope we're not moving as fast as I'd like to.
Yeah, I think that's probably for a lot of us is, I think a lot of us see sort of some markers, you know, some benchmark that we can get to faster if it was applied differently. And I guess it's frustrating when you can't seem to sort of reach some of those, you know, things that we're trying to, that's almost like in you can almost touch it, you know what I mean, in some of these things, and we can't seem to really make it happen, you know, and I guess that's frustrating. So I'm hoping that the coming year is going to bring more of that, you know, and hopefully be able to let us make some of these changes, or at least make bigger steps and bigger strides towards it, you know. But again, it's podcasts, it's the blog posts, that, you know, blogging that you're doing, Bob, and others out there that I think are, I think, opening the eyes to people.
We got to just keep the discussion going.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, that's going to be the most important part.
Bob, we're almost out of time, but I want to thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. I
know I'm glad I could make it.
When you're working, it's difficult.
Happy New Year, Bob.
Thanks, you too.
I wish everybody a Happy New Year. I'll actually be on the One Union 801 webcast tomorrow night at 10:30 with John Broyles. I'll be popping on his show tomorrow night. And I guess
we are doing that because I didn't see any follow-up on that sucker.
I'm planning on it.
All right, cool.
I hope the hell he's going to – I hope he'll be there.
John, you still doing that, man?
So hopefully he'll – as far as I know, he's still doing it, and I plan on being there for that.
Yeah, I've definitely blocked out that time.
Guys, we will – I guess we'll see everybody in next year, so stay safe, guys.
Bob, all right, happy New Year.
You too,
thank
Bob.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'll talk to you soon. All right, John. Yeah, John, I'll see you tomorrow night on the show, 10:30 Eastern time, I'm guessing.
I'll be there too.
And I guess we'll talk a little bit more about all kinds of fun stuff and, you know, maybe have a nice, relaxed time. I will not be drinking, so don't worry.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to – I'll make up for the both of us there.
Yeah, that won't be happening. So – all right, guys, that's it. Have a Happy New Year, everybody. Guys, thanks for listening in. Any comments, send them over to me. My email is jhoffman@emsafety.com. And we will see you in 2013. Josh, have a great week, and I'll talk to you tomorrow night as well.
Sounds good, Jim.
All righty. All right, everybody, good night. As always, Jim Hoffman, EMS Office Hours. Happy New Year, and as always, guys, especially tomorrow, guys, stay safe.